time for Yakety Science.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Yakety Science, the Tulsa Science Show. We are the program that shines a bright but humorous light into all of the darkest corners of the Mariana Trench, the Cayman Trough, and the Challenger Deep. We are the show that finds the haiku in your hydrology, the sonnet in your cytology, the ode in your odontology, the villanelle in your virology. I am Brian Cross, Associate Professor of Biology at Tulsa Community College and your humble host. First up, as always, the Starbuck to my Ahab, my co-host, Matt Smith, Associate Professor of Chemistry at Tulsa Community College. Say hello to the nice people, Matt.
Hello, nice people.
And our guest today is Dr. Evan White of LIBR, that is the Laureate Institute for Brain Research. Dr. White is the director of the EEG Corps. He is director of Native American Research, and we'll be talking to him more about the work of LIBR and his own particular research, so we have that to look forward to later in the show. So what's going on, Matt? Anything to report?
I do not. Tell me something interesting from your life.
Well, I can tell you one of my pet peeves, and this comes to me every semester as I am showing videos to my students, because I teach zoology, and so I am showing them lots of videos of different interesting creatures, of snails having sex and things. And so, you know, but the really annoying thing is it's so hard to find a video where they have not added just these really loud sound effects that are clearly not from the actual creatures themselves.
You'll have, yeah.
It's like, it's like some, there's some, what do you call them? Foley men, is that what they're called?
Yeah, a Foley artist. Yeah,
a Foley artist.
There must be over a nature's Foley artist.
Foley artist. But it's just, it's so misleading and so deceptive. I'm sure that they think they're making the videos better, right, and more entertaining. But what they're actually doing is deceiving the public, because you're not really aware of it unless you're teaching zoology like I am, and you're wanting it to be real, and you're focusing on it a bit more. You just listen to it and assume that that's the actual sound. So, like we had the bighorn sheep colliding together. I can't tell you how many videos are out there. It's the vast majority of videos out there where they've added a sound effect at the point where the two heads connect together so that it sounds much more dramatic, so that it sounds, I mean, it already sounds dramatic, but they add that so it sounds like a gunshot going off or something. And it's really, really deceptive, because then you don't know what's the real sound and what's not. So it's just frustrating to me. Why do we have to do this? And we have all this conversation these days about, like, you know, deep fakes and, you know, can we trust what we're seeing? This is an example of something that has been going on for a very long time, this addition of these sound effects in a way that has been deceiving the public for a very long time. And you could say, well, maybe it's a minor sort of thing, but it's just kind of losing touch with the actual thing itself, right? It's one more step removed from the actual biological entity. So it frustrates me.
You know, there's a similar problem I have with other nature videos where they try to, like, build a story into it. Uh-huh. And so they have all these, like, you know, shots, you know, macro image shots of, you know, uh-huh. like this, the ant moving or the grasshopper moving. And they're like, oh no, uh-huh. there's a spider nearby that might get it. And, uh-huh. you know, and they're trying to make drama and stuff like that. And it's like, those things are not near each other in actuality. They're yeah. just filming them so that they look like yeah. they're chasing one another.
Yeah, they're not. They're editing things together in the way that
they're just trying to make
Stanley Kubrick edits things together in order to tell a story. So, yeah. So, and that too, it can be distorting, right? I mean, it can be, if they're actually putting together a story that reflects something real, right, then maybe that's defensible. But they're also sometimes just putting together a story they think is going to grab the attention of the audience. And there you're deceiving people into thinking that two things are happening in sequence, that two things are happening close to each other when they actually happened on different days. You know, you're again deceiving the audience.
All right. Nature is very exciting, but it was not directed by Michael Bay.
And it was not narrated by David Attenborough. So. All right. Who just turned 100, so.
He did. Yeah. Good for him.
Who, on the whole, has been a force for good. So I am not anti-David Attenborough. I want to make that very clear.
Yeah. Hear that? He might be anti-David Attenborough. Who else would say that? Who would ever say, whoever goes out into the world and says, I'm not against David Attenborough, except for someone who was against.
Saying that I doth protest too much?
I'm saying that you doth protest far too much.
I think it's time that we move on. You're supposed to be on a villain arc, not me.
I need a sidekick. I need a henchman.
There you go. I'm not going to be your henchman. You'll be my henchman.
Oh, so you'll be the villain now.
I'll be the villain. Okay. Okay, I think it's time for some puzzling. Are you ready to be puzzled, Matt?
I know you are. I am often puzzled.
Eirenikos prosphilos eleluth.
First up, we need to deal with the sound science puzzler. In this segment of the show, I'll ask you about a science-related sound. It could be the sound that an animal makes. It could be the sound of a natural phenomenon. It could be a sound that's associated with science in some other way. Here is your new sound science puzzler. That horrifying sound is your sound science puzzler. Matt, do you have any idea what that might be?
I have never heard this before, but I'm pretty sure Tiffany has heard this. I think this is a sound you make when you want some attention.
I don't have to make any sounds. It's all spontaneously comes in my direction. I don't ever have to solicit.
It's horrifying. for attention.
It sounds like Chewbacca being murdered, strangled to death,
tortured. It's a cross between like a porg, you know, when the porgs go scream, you know, and
what's the porg?
The little puffin stands in.
Oh, okay. Yeah. On the island where Luke Skywalker is.
It's like the cross between a porg and Chewbacca.
Yeah. It's horrifying, whatever it is. But we'll all find out together at the end of the show. And as always, your admonition: you must listen to the rest of the show every last second
or else whatever this is will haunt you forever.
That's right. Yes, you're going to hear this noise in your sleep. The guilt will drive you mad. All right, that's it. I guess we're ready for the headlines.
Let's do some lines.
That's different, Matt. I'm not sure you fully understand the nuances of the English language.
That's fair.
It's time for the headlines. In this segment of the show, we trawl through, or perhaps troll through, the science-y headlines that have struck our fancy since the last episode of Yakety Science. So Matt, did you hear the latest news? Scientists are going bigger, longer, deeper.
Do you really think the world needs more of your childish double entendres?
I've always assumed so, but just out of curiosity, why do you ask?
There's no reason. Just tell me about whatever it is we're learning about.
I am, of course, referring to, everyone knows, ice cores. Climate scientists have been pushing it, going farther in a thick area, and then drilling deeper, penetrating into...
Stop. Please stop.
I don't think I can, and neither can the scientists of Beyond Epica, which is the project drilling these ice cores. They've pushed our direct record of atmospheric CO2 back from 800,000 years, the span covered by the longest previous ice core, which was called what? You want to guess?
No, what was it called?
Epica. So this one's Beyond Epica. The first one was Epica.
Oh my gosh. Scientists, you are so lame.
So they're trying to push it back all the way to 1.5 million, but this most recent effort has pushed it back to 1.2 million. So that's still pretty good. They've added an extra 400,000 years to our record of atmospheric CO2.
That's good, good. Okay, we can get to the science now, and you can stop making whatever these jokes are.
By the way, we want to make sure that our listeners do not confuse Epica, or Beyond Epica, this ice core project, with Epica, the hardcore Dutch symphonic metal band founded by Mark Janssen. Here's a little bit of that. So that is not what we're talking about.
Okay, well, if you're done with your review of weird European death metal.
You mean symphonic metal with death metal influences.
Right, of course. Of course. That's what I meant. I didn't know you were a connoisseur.
I'm really not. This is the random result of a Google search.
If you're done, finally, can we talk about the ice cores and how they tell us about CO2?
Yes, of course. I would be happy to. It's all about the little bubbles. It's like champagne. It's all about the little bubbles. Every winter and summer, you get distinct layers added to the ice in Antarctica, and within these layers, you get trapped little bubbles of atmospheric gas. That air can be directly measured to see the CO2 levels, and you can also look at isotope ratios of things like oxygen, right, within them to get the temperature, right?
Because if the water molecules have oxygen 18, which is an isotope of oxygen instead of the normal oxygen 16, then it'll be a little bit heavier, and therefore more of it will end up freezing to a solid. So during colder temperatures, you have a slightly higher isotopic ratio of oxygen 18.
Right. I think there's also an effect. It's pretty complicated because there's an effect where like the oxygen 18 falls out closer to the equator, and then not as much of it makes it to the poles, and so you get shifts and so on. But anyway, experts can analyze those ratios.
Experts who are not us
can analyze those ratios in order to look at temperatures. We can also get oxygen ratio of from calcium carbonate sediments within the ocean, and so you get two different perspectives on the same thing.
It's all very useful.
It's all very useful, right? And it's very useful that we've pushed this back to 1.2 million years ago, because that puts us into the MPT, which, of course, Matt, is the...
Of course, it's the mid-Pleistocene transition.
It definitely did not sound like you were reading it. That's the mid-Pleistocene transition, right? Recall that the Earth's climate has been swinging back and forth between glacials, which we commonly refer to as ice ages, and interglacials, which are these warmer periods, right? We've been doing that for the last 2.6 million years. All of human civilization takes place in the most recent interglacial. And during the MPT, we had a very important shift, which is that we went from short ice ages to long ice ages, right? So it went from ice ages, glacial periods that were about 45,000 years to ones that were about 100,000 years. And so for the last million years, right, it's been 100,000 years, and then you have a very short interglacial in between, and then 100,000 years of glacial, and so on.
Does anyone have any guesses as to why what change occurred?
Well, I mean, a lot of this has to do with the orbit of the Earth and the tilt of the Earth's axis, and you've got these cycles that are well known, but we don't really understand exactly why the length changed here at this point. But we do know that it was, carbon dioxide is at least tracking it, if not causing it, right? Because we get this sort of big drop of CO2 down to the lowest it's ever been recorded at 170 parts per million right before the first long glacial happens. And so the CO2, seems to be involved. And, of course, we come back to over and over again the central role that CO2 seems to play in these climate patterns. We see through time it tracking with the temperature, the CO2 and temperature tracking each other. And of course, right now, we're in this big, huge ascent in terms of the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, right? People may have seen the Keeling curve, where you see this sort of precipitous increase here in the amount of CO2. We're up to 170 is that number that I just gave you there for that ice age. Now we are at about 430 parts per million, and it just goes up every year.
And it's not going to stop. We're never going to stop it.
Anyway, this is an important addition to our data set as we try to figure out how the climate works, and as we try to figure out how the forcing that we're putting into the system, right, with the addition of all this CO2 and all of the energy that it's trapping, right, as it's an important kind of piece of our ability to model climate and understand what's happening to us right now.
Mm-hmm. You need to see what's happened in the past to know how things are going to be in the future.
All right. Up next, I think we have that old children's story, the country raccoon and the city raccoon.
Oh, right? I like that one very much. Absolutely. No, raccoons are showing maybe signs of domestication. Which, as anyone who...
Oh, for those who don't know, this raccoon, this is what some people call the trash panda.
Oh, right, of course, yes, the trash panda, yes, yes, yes. The those little backyard bandits, whatever. But it's a funny little rule about domestication. As you study domestication, notice a funny little rule that domestication starts with the garbage heap.
That's right. Yeah. So it starts with association with humans, and what do humans produce a lot of?
We make a lot of trash, make a lot of garbage. So animals that can adapt their behaviors to benefit from this garbage end up domesticating themselves. Now, this is a little bit different than like humans domesticating like cattle and stuff like that.
Right.
But no, this is other things that domesticate themselves, like dogs and cats domesticated themselves to fit into the human higher, you know, kind right. of life story.
It's really like nothing. I mean, it's more like natural selection to a human environment.
You say that, and I prefer the narrative that they love us and they want to be with us.
Well, they're not like organizing themselves in order to, you, Ned, you breed, and and you, Will, over there, you're a hothead, so you don't get to breed, right? What's happening is that just the ones that are better adjusted to and are calmer in the presence of humans, those are going to get more of that tasty, tasty trash, and they are going to leave more offspring behind. And so you get this process of selection happening over the generations, and emerging out of that, you get domestication.
But it's always been wondered, is like, why do certain other traits kind of tag along with this? Like the lowered fear response, but also you notice, even back to those fox experiments, you know, in Russia,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Shorter muzzle.
Yeah, the shorter muzzle.
Or the wider
floppy
fur.
The floppier ears.
The white fur.
They're all kind of like connected to each other, and they're noticing the same similar sort of trends in raccoons.
I think this is called domestication syndrome. It's been known since the time of Darwin.
Yeah, but I've always wondered why those specific traits are, like, connected in this. Why, like, I get that, like, we decide that it's cute, but...
Yeah.
Are all these traits kind of connected to this?
Yeah, and you don't have to select directly for those traits to get them. If you just select for ones that are calmer, more docile, then you get those traits. I don't think we know exactly why that is, why they're all connected together, but there is a hypothesis that relates to a particular group of embryonic cells called the neural crest cells, and the idea is that all of those traits are connected to effects of the neural crest cells. And so if you're selecting for something that changes the developmental pattern, that little bit of it, then it affects all those different things. You get what's called pleiotropy, lots of different effects from one change.
I guess that is kind of a, when you're shopping for genes and selecting for genes, it's kind of a package deal.
Yeah.
So I guess they're selecting for the lowered fear response, but they're getting along with that package, a shorter snout, floppier ears,
right,
and all these other cute things. I guess it's nice that they were cute.
I guess it could have made
them... That's fortunate.
Could have made them giant.
And right, yeah. Well, they're not afraid of us.
I mean, their teeth longer.
So. Yeah, they're not afraid of us, but they look awful.
Right. Anyway, so what did this particular bit of research focus on?
Oh, well, they were looking at pictures captured of raccoons in urban areas, and they were measuring their snouts and saying, oh, look, the city raccoons are showing shorter snouts than the raccoons out
there. So they were using iNaturalist pictures, I think?
Apparently, yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, well, obviously, this is preliminary research, and we hope that, they're going to follow up, and then we'll learn something more definitive. But I want to talk about the other children's story that I see here in the notes, Matt. What is that called?
Yeah, it's not the fox and the hound. It's the coyote and the badger.
Excellent.
Is a story.
Yes. And this is coming to you from the University of Disney?
That's right. Yes, that's right. No, my wife happened upon this article about some interspecies cooperation between researchers are noticing that coyotes and badgers. This is, by the way, American badgers.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that European badgers are pretty.
They hang out with frogs and
toads.
Yeah,
and they have those like wearing tuxedos. The black and white ones. They're pretty. I'm sorry. We have the American badgers, which look.
They live in trailers.
They look scary, is what they look like. Yeah, they noticed that coyotes and badgers would hunt together, not all the time, but like during like certain times of the year. And because they have their own little niche, you know, if they're after a sort of burrowing critter, well, if it burrows, the badger can go after it.
Mm-hmm.
And if it runs, the coyote can run after it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, by their powers combined, they are a pretty hit duo.
Mm-hmm. So where was this research published?
Well, the article I picked up was just like a photographer picking up, like, oh, look, we're seeing these badgers and coyotes hunting together. But actual research into this dates back to like 1992 with the Journal of Mammalogy, mm-hmm. Noticing the hunting associations between badgers and coyotes here in the Americas.
Interesting. The chemist teaches me biology. All right,
very
interesting.
I think it's cute.
It is it's a heartwarming story about badgers and coyotes getting together to murder other woodland creatures. I think what could be more heartwarming than that?
I mean, that's what nature's all about.
All right, very good.
Totally natural thing in it.
Next, we have Matt's Chemical Minute, a segment lasting 5 to 7 indeterminate units of time. Matt is going to tell us about an element, compound, or other entity that we should care about. It'll be an element. He will then give this entity a rating of 1 to 5 stars. I will listen and then potentially argue with Matt about his rating. Today, Matt takes up the most scandalously Nordic of all elements, that is scandium. Atomic number 21. Take it away, Matt.
That's right. It's our very first D-block element.
And it is actually named after Scandinavia, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. It is. Yeah. Yeah. Do you know where the D-block is on the periodic table?
Is it the center?
What's that area? Center bit? The part that's like bits. Lower than everywhere else?
The narrow bit.
Yeah. where most of the transition metals reside is the D-block.
And this is our first transition metal?
It's our first transition metal and first element in the D-block. So it has, we have different subshells mm-hmm. Within the electron cloud. We have S, P, D, and F. Mm-hmm. And so we've had S elements, P elements, and now it's mm-hmm. our first D element. It's going to be a long time before we get to the F subshell.
So we're moving to the outer shell here.
That's right. That's what we have.
But it becomes kind of fuzzy in here, doesn't it? Like the shells get all intermingled.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And actually, you said to the outer shell, but actually D block, D subshells are always interior shells. They're never in the valence shell.
Oh, are they? Right.
Isn't that wild?
That's wild.
Yeah. So, no, but this was discovered in 1879 by Lars Fredrik Nilsson. He was indeed a Swedish chemist at the University of Uppsala. And he did indeed name scandium for Scandinavia. Which, have you ever seen Swedish battleships, by the way?
I have, they're like Viking ships, aren't they?
Well, they have, if you look, no, I mean like the modern, you know, Swedish battleships, they have these vertical white and black lines painted on the side of them. Mm-hmm. And you think it's like dazzle camouflage, mm-hmm. you know, if you've ever heard of that. But actually, it's literally just a barcode. Mm-hmm. It's a barcode so that when the battleships come home, someone can just, you know, sit there on the shore with a barcode scanner, and then as they roll in, they can just Scandinavian.
Mm-hmm. That was a long walk. Very long walk for a very bad pun. I thought this was going to be an IKEA. This is going to be an IKEA reference, right? So, do they put together their ships with an Allen wrench?
That's what I was. Yeah. Well, that's what the element was. It actually is just shaped like an Allen wrench. Is what scandium is. Yeah. We use scandium to make Allen wrenches, or maybe if they were really expensive Allen wrenches, we could make scandium Allen wrenches.
Because this is a rare earth metal, so we don't have a lot of it, right?
It is technically, yeah. So it was just predicted to exist, you know, about a decade prior in 1869 by Mendeleev. Yeah. He made a few, you know, predictions of elements that would fit into these little slots in his periodic table, and one of them was,
I learned something interesting about Mendeleev.
I'm ready.
Are you ready? There's this story that Mendeleev, the periodic table came to him in a dream. You know, like he dreamed about all these
periodically Kekulé repeated. And the benzene structure? What's up with these people in dreams?
So that's the story that people told, but it's actually not true. He was writing a textbook, and he was trying to organize things for a textbook, and he started putting them into chunks, right, for a textbook for chemistry students, and then realized, oh, you know, there's some value to
there's
this.
There's some value on a table.
So the only great thing to ever come out of writing a textbook.
I guess no one had ever made a table before. Uh-huh. No one ever organized an Excel spreadsheet in the rows and columns. Yeah.
It's true.
No, never.
I'll bet they had. I'll bet people had done rows and columns before that.
I bet they had too. Yeah.
Accountants had definitely done that.
I don't know. But Mendeleev did call... he predicted the existence of an element he called Ekaboron. Now, Ekaboron is a name I don't like.
Yeah.
Ekaboron means below boron.
Yeah.
Now, is scandium below boron? It is not.
Okay.
What's below boron is aluminum.
Okay.
And we already knew aluminum.
Right.
So it's like he called it, the name ekaboron makes no sense.
Okay. Is it below aluminum?
No, it's not even below aluminum. Below
aluminum would
be gallium.
Okay.
So, no, but I mean, the periodic table as laid out by Mendeleev is not exactly what we have now.
Right.
You know, it is a table. Mm-hmm. It does have elements in it, but they are not arranged in the wonderful periodic table shape that we have today.
Yeah. We've improved on
it. But even looking at his thing, he has boron, and then there is already something below boron. Oh. So it's like, what do you call this thing? Ekaboron, man. Like, I don't know. I mean, props for kicking off the work on a periodic table, but your early versions needed some work. All right. I mean, I guess, which is always just true.
I feel like we're getting off on a tangent here. Back to scandium.
Back to scandium. So scandium's... the best thing about scandium, the other thing that makes it cool, is that it's one of those miracle alloy elements. Mm-hmm. You know, metals were like adding like a small amount of it to mm-hmm. alloy with another metal makes it mm-hmm. really good. Mm-hmm. And so like usually it's aluminum. So adding like less than 1% by mass to some aluminum makes a scandium aluminum alloy that writes its own Daft Punk lyrics. Harder, better, lighter, stronger. You liked that, didn't you?
No.
Yeah, you did. I need auto-tune is what I need, and I need to modulate my voice to sound like a robot.
You need to not be a moron.
That is so rude. I can't believe you said that. Goodness. But there is also the scandium paradox, which refers to the fact that scandium is, in fact, more abundant on this Earth than other metals such as lead, but it's not concentrated into like veins and deposits mm-hmm. like lead is. So
it's hard to
you can't really mine it up. No one builds a scandium mine because the scandium is really just dispersed all over.
Right.
And so,
it comes out as a byproduct then as you're processing other things.
Yep.
Is that it?
Yep. You're separating it out of the, you know, leftovers from your other mines. Mm. So you don't get it unless you're adding on the secondary process to separate it from the metal you're actually built the mine for. Mm-hmm. So scandium, even though it is more abundant, it is harder to get and therefore more expensive. And less used. So there are other alloying dopant elements out there, mm-hmm. like titanium. And titanium, even though it's not actually as good at it as scandium, but it just gets done because it's so much cheaper to get to.
Yeah.
So much easier to get to. So
it's an elusive element.
It is a bit. It is a bit. So that is, as you can guess by the amount of segues I put in there, all I have for scandium.
So we were like 50% pun. That's right.
You know, I think that makes it the best element ever.
All right. So a rating?
A rating, honestly, I really can't rate it that highly. Sure, like cool alloys.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just give it a 2.
Give it a 2.
It's not making me mad, so I'm not going to give it a 1.
Well,
I'll give it a 2.
Based on the fact that the Vikings terrorized my ancestors, I'm going to give it a 1.
Okay, very well. Yes, punishment.
Just as punishment.
In retribution.
So
Brian demands reparations from scandium.
So 2 and a 1. So that averages out to 1.5 for scandium.
Indeed, so it does. So
excellent.
It does.
So next time we'll be talking about, I think, titanium, isn't that it?
That's right.
Aren't you impressed with how
well I
know the periodic table?
Well, after I tell you the answers, I love it too.
Next up, we have the segment where we yak with a scientist. And I am sitting here with Evan White of the Laureate Institute for Brain Research, which is LIBR. He's one of their principal investigators, and we're here today just to learn more about LIBR, to learn more about his lab and what he does here.
Well, thanks, Brian. I really appreciate you being here. As you said, I'm here at LIBR. I'm a principal investigator. I also wear a couple of different hats for the Institute. In addition to my lab, I also serve as the director of the EEG Corps, stands for electroencephalography. And what that is I just help facilitate other labs use the EEG recording equipment and set up data processing pipelines.
Okay.
And then I also serve as the director of Native American research, which is really relevant for my lab.
Let me have you zoom out just a little bit here. So can you tell us about LIBR, what its mission is, what its goals are? And then we can talk about maybe how the core services fit within that larger mission.
So. Yeah, absolutely. LIBR has the broad mission of using clinical neuroscience to impact downstream care. So in the broad field of mental health research, there's often a fairly large gap between what we are doing in terms of advancing clinical research in understanding and defining mental health problems, as well as the solutions to those problems, and then what's the standard of care in clinical practice. LIBR's mission is really in that gap. How do we create a bridge between the clinical neuroscience that's happening and the downstream clinical care?
All right, so you're trying for this sort of vertical integration where you have the more sort of abstract research into how the brain works, how psychiatric disorders work, and so on, and you need to integrate that into what is actually happening with the patient in the clinic and addressing their neuropathology.
Right, yeah. And I think it could be summed up as better mental health through neuroscience. We're still, in a lot of ways, trying to figure out exactly what drives a lot of mental health conditions. You know, people broadly hear about things like depression, trauma, suicide ideation, substance misuse or substance abuse. Yeah. And what we know is, even with those singular labels, there's lots of different ways that people experience that suffering. Right. And the ways that that experience translates into biological function are even more nuanced.
Right.
And so understanding that helps us be more targeted with our treatments and more effective, hopefully.
Right. And you have some really cool tools for trying to get at the underlying processes. And you mentioned one, which was the EEG core, which is electroencephalography. And that's been around for a while. That's an older technology, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a little over 100 years now.
A little over 100 years now, excellent, yeah. But then you also have fMRI here as well, too. Can you talk about some of those four kind of tools that you guys have here at LIBR?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll be able to speak to things like EEG much more thoroughly than some of the other techniques that I'm aware of. So you mentioned EEG. It's about 100 years old. This is an electrical brainwave recording from the scalp. So we don't have to do anything more invasive than maybe messing up your hair and adding some gel.
Right.
And one thing we should note about that is the technology of applying electrodes to the scalp is actually a limiting factor in the representativeness of this data. And I think it's something that we should address when we talk about EEG, that there are certain hair textures and styles that have made the standard approaches to EEG. The standard approaches to EEG are limited in their ability to collect referential data.
And I suppose people are probably not really excited about you like shaving their head for
well, to be clear, for anyone out there considering participating, we're not shaving heads. But we do wear these caps. The standard design right now is a cap that looks something like an early aviator cap. You know, it's pretty tight fitting to your head, straps under your chin, and it's dotted with little electrodes. And then we insert some gel, and it's got saline in it.
Right.
And so the idea is it's creating a conductive medium between the electrode and your scalp. Those electrodes are sensitive then to the electrical fluctuations that are happening in the cortex of your brain. And so, again, we use that because it tells us a little bit about what's going on the surface of the brain in terms of electrical potentials. Mm-hmm. And then when we put people in controlled environments, meaning like really boring video games is how I describe them, we can start to pair specific brain activity measured by these electrodes with specific, what we call cognitive demands or specific types of thought processes.
Is the EEG measuring mostly activity within the cerebral cortex?
The neural activity that drives the EEG signal is pyramidal neurons in the cortex. Okay. So if you think of the wrinkly part of your brain, all these folds, inside those folds, there's basically a forest of pyramidal neurons releasing neurotransmitters outside of the cell, and they're all charged a particular way that can change the electrical potential in the surface of the cortex. And so a lot of people may have heard of action potentials of a neuron, like when it fires and the electrical charge goes down the cell. That's not what we're measuring with EEG.
You're measuring the synaptic activity.
Exactly. We're measuring what's called a postsynaptic potential. So the potential outside the synapse.
Okay. Is that a neuron on your arm?
Oh, yeah. So yeah, this is a tattoo that I got about a year ago, actually. It's a hybrid pyramidal neuron, and then actually it's a teepee from a Native American church service that shows Native American church services are generally at night inside of a teepee and there's a fire. So when you're outside, you can kind of see the silhouettes of people inside. And it's just something that I doodled for years and eventually thought, you know, I'd like it.
Why not?
As a tattoo. Yeah. So a little bit nerdy, but I'm a little bit nerdy. So.
No, that's okay. That's science, right?
Yeah, so, I guess so.
That's our audience.
Great. Yeah.
And then you also have the, what does the fMRI give us? I know that's not your specialty, but it's what does the fMRI give us in addition to that picture we get from the EEG?
The weakness of EEG in this way is because it's an electrical recording and your whole head is electrically conductive, there's a good temporal resolution. The electrical things are very fast, but spatially, it's fairly imprecise. And that's where fMRI has an extremely strong advantage, is you can be very precise with location when you're using an MRI, particularly as you get into the stronger MRI. So here we have 3 Tesla MRIs, and I believe that gives us a spatial resolution on the order of a few millimeters.
And what is the fMRI tracking?
So fMRI is tracking what's called the blood oxygen level dependent signal. This is the movement of oxygen throughout the brain. That's kind of a metabolic indicator of
activities.
So we know kind of which regions are active under particular context. So we can start to make inferences about which regions of the brain are more or less active when people are engaged in a, let's say, emotional processing or a very hard task where we're really concentrating or exerting a lot of attentional control.
All right, so you've got those core services available. Are you doing genetic work and taking samples and looking for genetic markers and integrating that with your fMRI and your EEG? Is that sort of thing going on? Or
yeah, it's definitely a toolkit that's available at Liber broadly. In my own personal work, we've not delved into the genetic components. I had a really talented RA, Elizabeth Rojas, who worked on some molecular data in combination with the experts here. I believe they call them the Circuits and Molecules Core. That's one of the really strong features of Liber, in my opinion, is that we have cutting edge experts on these techniques and that collaboratively we can bring those skill sets together in a way that's really powerful and for science.
This may be a good time to do a pitch here because I know that you're always looking for subjects to participate in these different projects.
Sure. Yeah. And that, it feels like a lot of pressure. All my colleagues are like, do it well. No. But in any case, what I would say is, you know, if you have an interest in contributing to our understanding of mental health broadly, and I want to be clear, one of the things that oftentimes we hear is, well, I'd like to participate, but I'm not sure that I'm a good candidate. And the reality is we need participants from a wide range of experiences. And so I would just say, if there's any interest at all that you have towards contributing to our understanding of mental health, you know, you can reach out to Liber through our website. We have a sign-up portal. Someone will call you.
Yeah, and so I actually did participate. I was put into an fMRI machine and shown different images. And, you know, I had to, recognize which images were the same. They're images of faces.
Mostly. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I came away with a set of images of my brain, which is which is
right.
Fun. It's just fun to look at. I thought it would have been bigger, you know?
I was able to get a little 3D model, a 3D printed model of my brain.
Oh, cool.
And it's, I think it's a 1/8 size, but when it was presented to me, the joke was, it's actually life size.
No, but it was really exciting. And I was actually teaching human anatomy at the time, so I could share that with my students. And it was really cool.
Yeah, and we still can provide, I do believe, the structural scans, which is like the pictures of the brain structure to participants.
Right. Yeah. What are the funding streams that support mm-hmm. Liber? How does that work?
Yeah, so Liber is a 501c3 nonprofit that was founded by the Warren Family Foundation, set up for Liber. So we kind of have a foundation in that funding. And then in order to power a lot of our studies and, you know, scale up the work that we're doing, we compete for extramural funding through a variety of grant mechanisms. One of the large sources of funding that we apply for are National Institutes of Health funding. Mm-hmm. That come through a couple of different institutes there, and they fund extramural research projects. We also, I should give a shout out to my colleagues, Dr. Robin Opperly and Masaya Masaki, who just recently got funding through the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Mm-hmm. But in any case, so I guess those are examples of how we get extramural funding. It might be through federal funding or private foundations that are interested in specific mental health questions.
Have any of the funding sources been disrupted over the last... Oh, let's just say 18 months or so.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think, yeah, we've had some disruptions here and there. We've been fortunate that the disruptions that we faced seemed to be temporary. We had a couple of grants come under scrutiny last year, even in the lab. We were able to work with our federal partners to have those grants reinstated. And so I would say that no more so than the field in general in terms of federal funding disruptions. Yeah,
but that may still be pretty significant, right?
Yeah, so I mean, the
situation has not been great for federal funding of research.
Yeah, I would say it's definitely been top of mind for most of the scientific field that I'm aware of.
Your own particular lab, your lab's called the New Air Lab.
Right.
Can you tell us what that stands for?
Yeah, so New Air is an abbreviation or acronym that stands for Neuroscience of American Indian Resilience and Risk. And broadly, the goal of that is to say, how can we understand the individual factors, maybe at a biological level, that relate to resilience against mental health conditions and more broadly, just health, well-being, and thriving? Mm-hmm. As well as disruptions to health, well-being, and thriving that might lead to mental health conditions. You know, some of those specific focuses of ours are substance misuse and disorder. We've done a little bit of work in terms of suicide ideation and things of that nature, and then other, you know, relevant mental health conditions like trauma exposure, anxiety disorders, depression, those types of things. That's kind of our clinical focus. But we are particularly interested in serving Native American populations. Yeah.
Right. And so I know that you've done work with like the importance of culture to resilience. Can you say more about that?
Yeah. So there's a couple of things I should say. First, I want to acknowledge for anyone in the audience that might be aware of my use of collective terms here, like for American Indian, Native American. There's lots of different collective terms for what is really a large heterogeneous group of people.
Right.
And we try to use the language that is most related to the community partners we work with.
So, and you work with the tribes here in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Are there particular ones that you're
closest association in our work right now is with the Shawnee tribe of Oklahoma. And we have a project in partnership with them directly. And so when it comes to the cultural components that you're talking about, my work has really shifted in this way over the past 6 years or so to understanding specific aspects of culture that are particularly relevant for health, well-being, and resilience broadly, and particularly as it relates to mental health conditions. And if we want to zoom in even further, we're highly interested in substance use disorders and suicide risk and related conditions, as I mentioned before.
And so the rates of mental health issues is higher among the Native American community. Is that true or not?
I would say on a very high level view, that's not untrue. And the way that we think about it is, you know, disproportionate levels of occurrence of these types of conditions. And so I think about this as kind of a burden that's placed on the communities in terms of the occurrence of mental health conditions. And so we see higher occurrence of certain types of mental health conditions in populations whenever these risks accumulate. And that's true for American Indian populations in a lot of ways. But I would be remiss if I don't point out to the audience that an important point to recognize here is that when we account for risk factors across populations, and we have some data published on this a few years ago, is that when we actually take into account the relevant risk factors, let's say like access to care, access to educational and income resources, healthcare resources, and other factors that we know put people broadly at risk for developing mental health conditions, when we account for those risk factors, we actually don't see this disproportionate expression. And in some cases, we actually see relative resilience in Native populations. And that was actually what one of the pieces of data that made me interested in understanding what are the strengths that exist in our communities.
So are you able to compare, you know, individual Native Americans that are more and less connected to a community?
Yeah, I would say rather than thinking about it as comparing individuals, I think about it as, let's think about the dynamic of our connectedness to our traditional communities or traditional cultural practices. And this is a good point to clarify that the term culture in the way that we use it colloquially is really unhelpful as a scientific endeavor, in my opinion. And I tell people often,
it's too fuzzy.
Yeah, it's exactly. And when you start thinking about it carefully, it becomes clear really quickly how difficult this term can be, because it's really an umbrella term that captures so much of our lives as human beings. We're trying to find individual factors that we can then apply scientific toolkits in understanding how those factors relate to health and well-being in a way that informs treatment. And it brings the toolkit of LIBOR, like we're talking about filling that gap between neuroscience and clinical practice.
Right.
It brings that toolkit to populations that can benefit from this in a meaningful way.
Is there like a specific example here that you could give us to show us that connection and how you're using the tools of LIBOR?
So, for example, one facet of culture that has been studied scientifically broadly and in Native American populations is spirituality. And so early on, we're looking for, this is kind of a new novel idea, so we need to be using some established measure of cultural factors and well-established measures, from my opinion, of cognitive function. Mm-hmm. And so my background in EEG and cognitive functions, I had an empirical toolkit, a scientific toolkit, let's say, that allowed me to measure EEG and a specific cognitive function known as inhibitory control. And this is just kind of our ability to recognize something and stop a behavior that we're engaged in or about to engage in. And so that's a foundational function for—
You get mad and you don't punch the guy.
Yeah, something like that, exactly. So behavioral regulation, craving regulation. And what we've seen in my background, I studied anxiety in graduate school. Shout out to my mentor, Dr. Damon Grant, taught me about a lot of what I know as a clinical psychologist. That background, I was aware that when we're suffering from clinical levels of anxiety, we may be able to maintain behavior in certain contexts, like be effective at doing things. And I think people can relate to this. When you're feeling anxious, sometimes it's motivating. Sometimes it helps us get things done. But it's almost like running on high RPMs. It makes us a little less efficient and a little bit easier to be disrupted. And so if we can't measure that in behavior, we can measure it with EEG. And what you see is that under attentional demands, oftentimes there's larger, more effortful neural responses to these inhibitory control tasks.
Okay.
And when we brought that into our Native American populations, what we showed is that for individuals that are suffering with anxiety disorders, they did still show that kind of, let's say, neural inefficiency or more neural effort under control tasks. But when we stratified the sample based on their level of spiritual engagement, what we see is that the individuals that had high levels of spirituality actually showed greater neural efficiency in that task relative to those with lower spirituality. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, this is secondary data, small sample, so I want to caveat this for all of the general skeptical audience that, yes, this isn't definitive evidence to say spirituality is going to make your brain more efficient, but it does seem to be consistent with a protective effect in these individuals.
So the spirituality here is self-reported. Do you have a question there?
Exactly.
How often do you attend a church service, or how often do you pray?
And so actually, if anybody's really interested in the details, this is a paper published by another brilliant trainee of mine who's now a graduate student at Texas A&M. Her name's Nicole Bauman. That paper came out, I think, in 2023. And so you can delve into the details there, but yes, the spirituality measure we used is a survey where people respond to a variety of questions, and that gets kind of summed.
Have you thought about, or are you, maybe you're already doing this, having them do something like meditation, reflection, those sorts of things while they're being scanned to look for that sort of effect?
I guess the closest thing we've done to something like this is the development of what's called the American Indian Multimedia Stimulus Set, or AIMSET, and we published that a couple of years ago as well, where we worked through trying to create pictures, music, even video testimonials.
I saw this online. You had pairs of images that they were very similar, but one had a Native American valence to it and the other didn't.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So we had some cultural information, and the cultural information is broad because we weren't looking at an individual tribe. And then we can compare what is the brain doing when you're looking at cultural information versus not. And what we see from pictures is that you get an increase in electrical activity from EEG that shows motivated attention and sustained attention. So there seems to be more engagement with those attentional networks when people are looking at cultural information versus not. And in the fMRI, we see similar effects that we talked about with spirituality, is that there seems to be this kind of downregulation of prefrontal cortical regions that seems to be, you know, when people are processing, oh, do I relate to this image or not? There seems to be, you know, a more efficient categorization or relation to the pictures than in the non-cultural images. So there's actually, like, in some of the more executive control regions, less activity when they're relating to those images. And then for the videos and audios, we have a longer measurement, we actually see upregulation in medial parts of the brain that people might be familiar with, something like the default mode network, that's also associated with self-referential processing and things like that. So when people are watching these more dynamic stimuli, we seem to see more activation in those networks.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
Well, I do appreciate your time. Thank you for joining us here. It's been a really fascinating conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Before we go, we need to deal with the sound science puzzler. Here it is again, in case you've forgotten the horrifying sound.
God, it's horrifying.
There it is again. It's unforgettable. We really didn't need to play it again. All right. Did you figure out what it was, Matt?
Well, since I found it, yes, I know what it was. Did you find what it was?
I believe this is the Sika deer.
Is indeed the Sika deer.
Which is a deer that's native to East Asia, so Cervus nippon. So the Japanese deer or the East Asian Sika deer. This is kind of like ATM machine, one of those repetitions. So it's the Sika deer. Sika means deer, so it's the...
It's the deer deer.
It's the deer deer.
It's the deer deer.
The deer deer.
Along with the, you know, like Avon River, the river river.
Does Avon mean river?
It means river.
Avon River. The river river. So this is actually the sound of them rutting, or this is the bugling of the male Sika deer. All right, well, that's it. That's our sound science puzzler. Next time we'll have a brand new puzzler for you. As always, we leave you with a wise quote from a sciencey person of note. Matt, you've got the quote this time.
Today's quote comes to us from Neil deGrasse Tyson, who reminds us that the universe is under no obligations to make sense to you.
With those humbling words, we leave you, dear listener, until the next episode of Yakety Science. Thanks for listening.
That was magical.
No, it was science.
Yakety Science.
Never gets old. Yakety Science is produced, written, and edited by Matt Smith and Brian Cross. Production help provided by Scott Gregory. Theme music by Lobo Loco. Yakety Science is recorded at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa and at the Center for Creativity at Tulsa Community College. If you'd like to yak back at us, our email is yakettyscience@gmail.com. We love to hear from you.